session just got finished. What did I say we were?
House.
House rules? Senate rules? That's the time of session. We will hold over HJR 46, 3574, and 3953, if you're here for those. And when you see 3953, we'll just have a simple work session and get it down to Ways and Means. It has a fiscal, so that's where they'll be working it down there in the next several days. In the future, we're going to start meeting in the mornings on or about 9 o'clock, 8:30 to 9, probably for the rest of the session. The next 2 days will be redistricting joint hearings, so we won't have any bills. So Friday morning at 9 will be the next time we have stuff on the agenda. So just keep your eyes peeled. 1, 2, 3. All right, we will open public hearing on HJR 16 and start the hearing. Who signed up for that?
I thought we kind of had that there.
Yeah, never mind. I was just fooling. We won't get to 16 yet. We'll go to HJM 33. HJM 33. I'm in trouble with these houses and joints and senates. Yes. Sign up sheet for. Oh, so he's not here?
No.
Well, we'll get Senator Hartung out of the way. Okay, Senator Hartung.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for your courtesy to allow me to testify on SJM. It is SJM, it's 33.
HJM.
HJM.
And also, yeah.
I'm always very happy to be able to testify on behalf or for the livestock industry in this state, and this bill was developed by the producers. And the bill mentioned some important things, or the memorial in the bill. For instance, the fact that foot and mouth disease and the mad cow disease has occurred in other countries. We have not had foot and mouth in the United States since 1928, and there have been no incidents of mad cow disease. However, I am opposed to the bill, in that it has nothing to do with the promotion of American beef, and the country of origin labeling actually could have a detrimental effect in the long-term growth. I have a lot of material here, but I will not take your time to review that with you. But if I could just sum up in a word or two why I am opposed to this particular memorial, it is because it has nothing to do with food safety. In fact, I can point out countries in New Zealand, Australia, where the packing houses are operated in a manner that, as we say in the trade, the bug count is lower than they are in houses, packing houses in this state. I would like to find a way to do to this memorial something that would allow to increase the returns to producers, but I cannot see how we could do that because by its very nature, it's an entrepreneurial business. Let me just give a couple of items from the material I have, and I've got 9 pages of material, but I'll take 2 sentences on why I am opposed to this particular memorial. And I have voted for my share of the memorials, even recognizing that it is just asking the President and the Congress to do certain things. But here's the primary reason why I am opposed to this, and this comes from the weekly publication, the Cattle Buyers Weekly. And this memorial, or the country of origin labeling, remains the biggest. The biggest negative is that is the cost of it. It would cost approximately more than $1 billion annually, says the American Meat Institute. NCBA disputes that, but even at $500 million, the cost is enormous with no perceived economic benefits. This is the opponents talking now. I would be very concerned about diverting resources that would otherwise be devoted to food safety, to enforcement of country of origin labeling, which is not a food safety issue. The biggest danger is that other countries will do the same to the U.S., says the American Meat Institute. What if Japan and the European Union demanded COO, country of origin labeling, with trace back? The U.S. is most vulnerable to legal challenge if it says the origin relates to where an animal is born as distinct from where an animal is transformed, i.e. processed. And so that is the main reason that I must oppose this memorial, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions you might have.
Thank you, Senator. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Glenn Stonebrink, Gene Wilkinson. Anybody else? I've got the sheet up here. Anybody else signed up for 33?
Free card file.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. The House Joint Memorial 33 is really a consumer's right to know. Lately, with all of the media hype about mad cow disease, foot and mouth disease, I've had people ask me, where does the meat in this grocery store at Safeways, Albertsons, or wherever, where does that meat come from? Presently, the United States does not have mad cow or foot and mouth disease. But I can't answer. I cannot answer the question, and I'm in the meat industry. I can't tell them where that meat comes from because it's not labeled. We label all kinds of things in this country, clothing, even dog bones. But we, some reason, have a resistance to labeling the food that we buy for our families and feed our families. Why is that, basically? We've been dealing with this issue from the Oregon Cattlemen and the National Cattlemen for a number of years, and we find lots of resistance. 2 years ago in Congress, there was a bill up on country of origin meat labeling. It was mandatory. And one of the opponents said they had $30 million to spend to stop the country of origin meat labeling. Well, why would they be so intent on stopping this? And the answer is very simple. Follow the money. If you follow the money, there is a lot of meat, and we're interested in the beef side, but there's a lot of meat that is imported into this country. It's either processed, or if it comes in on the hoof, it's also processed, and it'll have a USDA stamp of inspection. And when you buy it in the store, you may think that's U.S. beef, and it's not. From the beef producer side of things, the beef that's raised in other countries does not follow the same environmental standards and laws that we have, nor the Food and Drug Administration standards that we have, the labor laws that we have. And so it makes what we call an unlevel playing field as far as competition is concerned. So we're not trying to stop meat from being imported. We're simply saying label the meat that does come in so the consumer has a right to know that. There are a number of countries that already do label, mandatory labeling in these other countries, and I do have some of those listed for you on the second page of my handout. And there's the... I won't go into that. I want to keep it as short as I can, but we feel that it's a issue of both fairness for the rancher or the food producers in this country, but most of all, it is a food safety issue. And if the meat that says U.S. meat costs more and the consumer wants to pay for that, that's fine. If they want to pay less for that that's foreign meat or blended meat, That's okay also. But the consumer will have a right to choose based upon that information. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, a little off topic, but when I first came to the legislature many, many years ago, the Oregon Cattlemen Association had this great program called Adopt a Legislator, and so I got to spend a weekend in Elgin with Tiny Bellamy and his wife, and drink Coors, which of course I had no experience doing prior to that event.
Two things could be risky.
Anyway, I just thought it was a great program, and I would really encourage you to do it again. It was the only thing like it that I've seen in the legislature, and I just thought it was really wonderful.
Thank you.
So, that was really an aside.
I always wanted to ride a bull.
I always wanted to drink Coors.
We have a lesson on that.
Don't you have to drink the Coors to ride the bull?
To be the bull.
Chairman Harper, members of the committee, I'm Jean Underhill Wilkinson.
You wouldn't know running behind, would you?
I'm Jean Wilkinson with the Oregon Farm Bureau. I handed out a little piece of testimony here, and I'm not going to repeat it all. This is Oregon Cattlemen's Association bill, and we definitely support them, and I think Glenn Stonebrink said it well. I'll repeat that country of origin meat labeling is simply a matter of informing the consumer, helping the consumer have confidence in what the consumer is buying, safety, and giving the consumer the opportunity to make a choice between foreign and domestic meat. Of course, all our meat is USDA graded, and it gives consumers a false impression that maybe they're buying American grown meat when that may not be the case. So it will take a congressional act to change those policies and the way USDA conducts that business. And we support that effort along with the American Farm Bureau. And on top of all, it would give our domestic meat producers the opportunity to maybe have an advantage as opposed to a marketing advantage as opposed to foreign meat producers by allowing the consumer to...
Public hearing, open work session, HJM 33.
Mr. Chair, I move House Joint Memorial 33 to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves HJM 33 to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection. Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Courtney, would you like to...
I will.
Okay. Close work session.
Good job, Mr. Chairman.
Open work session, reconsideration of House Bill 3528. We need to bring this back. The proponents are working with the governor's staff. I think they have some amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move we suspend the rules to reconsider the vote on House Bill 3528.
Senator Courtney moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3528. Further discussion, objection, hearing none.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote which we sent to the Senate for House Bill 3528 with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 3528 was sent to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none. So ordered.
It's before us. What do you
want? Is this Gene Tim's bill?
Well, it's Tim's. We need to sit on it until we get amendments. Okay, closed work session.
I'll ask you later.
Ask me now.
Well, I missed the public hearing because the governor called me. And as I was reviewing stuff, it's not like the information is like different. It's just like somebody says A and somebody else says E.
Welcome to the Capitol.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, we can sit down and tell you what I know. Yeah, I think you got a good point there. Close work session, open work session, House Bill 3641. We need to reconsider. We need an amendment to this one.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3641
and Gross. Senator Courtney moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3641. Discussion, objection, hearing none. So ordered.
I move we consider the vote by which House Bill 3641A and Gross was sent to the floor that they do pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 3641 was sent to the floor as amended the do pass recommendation. Discussion, objection, hearing none, so ordered. Okay, what happened here?
We have a minute.
Open work session, House Bill 3641.
Mr. Chair, I would move the -A2 amendment. Apparently, there was some issue about monies being combined into one common account, and I believe the amendment eliminates that provision in the bill.
Okay. Is that correct, Meg? Is that correct, Joe?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct.
Joe motions that that's correct. Further discussion. Senator Courtney, the A2, if you would please.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that the...
I'm sorry, Senator Brown.
She's already moved on.
This is the dash A2, Mr. Chair.
Am I still correct? Okay, hearing none, so ordered.
And Mr. Chair, I would move the bill as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Correctness?
And Senator Brown moves House Bill 3641 as amended for the due pass recommendation. Further discussion, objection, hearing none, so ordered. The original carrier was?
That'd be you?
Would you like to do it again?
I would be delighted.
Okay. Close work session. Open work session, House Bill 2756, reconsideration.
Again?
What happened to this one?
Sure.
We got some conflict amendments?
Conflict. Chair, I move the, where are we? Wait, what bill?
2756.
I just want to make sure I say the right thing. 2756. Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote on House Bill.
Spend the rule.
Chair. Yeah, now I don't know where we are.
Turn it right here. Read this.
Yeah, but I got to get the bill number.
2756.
How come it's not on my worksheet? Where's 27?
Okay. Third one down, Peter.
I understand there was something that I heard.
2756.
Well, you got a different one than my. Thank you. Mr. Chair, I move the suspend the rules, consider the vote on House Bill 2756A and gross.
I think the special vice chairman is talking.
Move the rules be suspended for the first reconsidered vote on House Bill 2756.
You supposed to say objection.
Yeah, any objections, hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move we consider the vote by which we say the House Bill 2756A goes to Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2756A goes to Senate floor is amended with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion, objection, hearing none, so ordered. Work session 2756.
Mr. Chair, I move the amendments of A5 to the House Bill 2756. Mr. Chair, did you hear what I just said?
Yes.
All right.
Just the conflict amendments.
The A5 incorporate both the conflict amendments and the A4 that we've already looked at in past.
Okay. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2756 goes as amended to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
The court moves House Bill 2756 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Consider them twice.
Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none? So ordered. Who had that the first time? What's in her minutes?
Yes, sir.
Continue to carry this one for us, please?
Yes, sir.
Close work session. Open public hearing, HJR 16.
Really good looking, man.
Well, Jake Oakenberg, Jeff Brewer, Chris Bergstrom.
We're talking
about. Okay, well, let's do that next. Do the most important bill of the session here next.
It's the Jason Esmond.
Right. You want to join in?
Do I sign this or not? No.
I know.
We're just out of Connecticut.
Sure. Whatever.
Chairman Harper, members of the committee, thank you very much for holding this hearing today. Just have a few brief comments on why I support HJR 16, and then would be happy to answer any questions you all may have. There's no one main reason why I support this or why anyone should. Instead, there are several key reasons. I'll try and outline those briefly. Without a doubt, this will be a benefit to young people. Having young people running for office gets other young people out there. I can testify to that with firsthand knowledge during my campaign for mayor just last year, running against incumbent Mayor Vera Katz. The amount of young people who got interested in the race, who actually took hold of the issues that were before them, could speak about them, was dramatically increased, and that was actually shown in the final vote totals, in which from the primary 2 years before to when the vote was taken for the mayoral election, the numbers in the metropolitan area of 18 to 34-year-olds that voted more than doubled. Now, I don't directly attribute that to my campaign, but it certainly did help. And, in fact, statistics in other states show much the same thing. But it also sends an important message that young people are important to our political system, but it's not a magic bullet. I wouldn't try and argue that here. This bill, along with get-out-the-vote efforts, national ones, statewide ones, will help, but it alone isn't the magic bullet. It has to be coupled with many other things, that many of which are already going on. The question that's on many people's mind is, of course, the experience question, which I've heard from a number of people. Do young people have the experience necessary to serve? First of all, we already see that 18-year-olds are judged to be old enough to vote, to serve in the military, and to run for most local offices. In fact, we have a gentleman here today who will represent that view of a city council. So we can see how there's a lot of instances where 18, 19, and 20-year-olds are doing many great things. And in fact, to answer that question, all we have to do is also look at the 17 other states and the District of Columbia that already allow people starting at age 18 to run for the state legislature. And just doing a quick search, we found at least 20 18, 19, and 20-year-olds who are doing exceptional work, and far from being overwhelmed and inexperienced, they're working on complicated policy legislation. They're serving on committees. In fact, one young gentleman is actually a chair of a subcommittee on education, and they're staying abreast of issues that will affect their constituents. So, without a doubt, I think the experience question can be answered by the real-life examples that we have out there. Lastly, the point I'll make to you is that I think one of the most important things about this is that it really is a matter of letting the voters decide. Sure, there's many young people who wouldn't be the best candidate for the district they're representing, just the same way that a 40 or 50-year-old might not be the best candidate. In the end, we have to let the voters decide that and be the judge of it. And I can tell you, again, some people may think a young person would be able to get out there and have a good chance, but there's a real high bar to get over as a young person running against anyone, and any good candidate running against a young person would point out that. And so I don't think this is something we have to worry about, this body being flooded with 18, 19, and 20-year-olds, just like it's not flooded with 21, 22, and 23-year-olds now. It's a matter of giving candidates, 18, 19, and 20-year-olds, the eligibility to run and then letting the voters decide. So with that, I would strongly urge you to move this to a work session today and get it out to the floor as soon as possible, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Jake, thank you. So you're proposing that you be allowed to run for the legislature?
Well, actually, I will be 21 by the next time. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Well, there's one of the things that the legislature or a legislator really should have is one of in his skill sets is the ability to know when he has a good bill not to talk it to death.
I hope you will, Mr. Chair, I hope you'll send my apologies to the people in your office who have heard from me a lot lately.
What's the strongest argument you have in favor of this?
As I start, Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, as I start off my testimony, I didn't feel that there is one central argument. There's many things that resonate with the members of the legislature as I've talked to them, and I personally don't have one main reason. That's why I tried to outline.
What's the reason in your mind that we should do this?
I think it's a simple matter of consistency about the things that we already allow 18-year-olds that we've judged that they can do in our society, and that we've felt that they're old enough at that age to fulfill those roles, that I think this would also be consistent with those ones that I outlined before.
Okay.
Thank you. Jeff.
Thank you, Chair Harper, and committee members for hearing this bill. For the record, my name is Jeff Brewer, and I'm a student at the University of Oregon. I'm testifying today in support of HJR 16 because I believe that it is imperative and essential to allow for young people to have the opportunity to be involved in the political process by allowing them to run for the legislature. Currently, I believe we are witnessing an age elitist form of government, as the average age of an Oregon legislator is 53.8 years old. Obviously, the younger voters are not being adequately represented, with no offense to you, Senator Atkinson.
Second message in being a legislator is don't offend the members of the committee.
I meant that without offending him. It was,
he might have offended me. I think
I apologize. Hey, I'm not here to hurt anybody's feelings. Another issue that I think is very important is getting young people involved. Getting young people involved is an ongoing puzzle that has to be put together, I believe, piece by piece. HGR 16 will not be the lone solution to youth voter apathy or disinterest. However, it is one piece of the puzzle, and it is a very extremely vital piece of the puzzle because it is an issue that speaks to the youth and concerns the youth. I believe if you want to get youth involved, you have to get out there and actually talk to them. You can't talk to them about the things they're not interested in. Sometimes it takes that step to really get involved, to understand the process, and then they can build on that. I will shorten up my written or my oral testimony here because I know you can read it.
Real short.
Yes. I'm going to end it right here. How does that sound?
Are you going to end it or not?
Yes, I am going to end this. Hold on one moment. I got to catch my breath here. You guys are cracking me up. If this this does not progress to the Senate floor, I think that we'll take a digressive step in youth involvement. And so I urge for a work session and a vote today and pass it on the Senate floor. Thank you very much. I'll answer any questions if you'd like.
Hey, you guys watch my lips. This is a pretty good bill. Everybody is okay.
I will say hello.
I don't want to intimidate you. Tell us what's on your mind.
Hello, my name is Chris Bertram. I'm from Tualatin, Oregon. Of the three of us here, I am probably the only elected official. I was elected at 18 to the Tualatin City Council, and I have quite an extensive background as far as helping to shape public policy in my community. I'm a student at Portland State, and with that, that's what I'll conclude with, unless there's any questions for me.
Well, why did you run for the council?
Why did I run for city council? To be quite honest, this may sound like a bad Hallmark card, Chair, but the reason I ran, as I grew up in a family that when you can give back to your community, it's something that you do. I had been doing that, and contributing back to my community is something that I've wanted to do, and hopefully will choose as a career path, and so this seemed like the next logical step for me. And so that's what I did.
How come you know this and my kids don't?
What's that?
All right, Chris, thank you. Senator Menace.
Will you three think about term limits? Because if you ran and won at 18, you'd be term limited at age 22. Of course, you've got the rest of your life, I suppose.
Jake, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Menace, I think that's an appropriate question. As many of you know, your public service career does not necessarily end in the legislature. Many people go on to serve city councils, run for mayor, or even on a federal level, going for U.S. Congress, so that there's many ways in the state of Oregon, in county commission, to continue to get involved. And so by no means would a young person who ran at a young age, would they be limited by the time they were termed out.
Well, if you're going to do this, when are you going to go out and earn a living? Never mind. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank
Representative
you.
Wilson.
Oh, can Representative Wilson talk in a short, concise? He sounds good. You can talk all the time. Senator Brown here.
Got to get the proper mic position here. Good afternoon, committee. For the record, I'm Carl Wilson, District 49 State Representative, Grants Pass, Cave Junction. I've approached this whole idea of 18-year-old service in the legislature perhaps different than some have. And I really look back on my military experience. I joined the Navy when I was 17 years old, had to have my mom and dad sign so I could go. And so I did, and before too long I wound up on the other side of the world in 1971. It was the height of the Vietnam conflict. I was about 500 miles away at the last drop-off spot before you get to Vietnam. And quite frequently, we were on Liberty and entertained in our own workspaces, individuals who were rotated out of Vietnam for just a week for R&R, perhaps. Maybe they were just back in for resupply or something of that nature. During that period of time, I had an opportunity to serve with some shipmates who were on a ship called the USS Newport News. And October 1 of 72, this ship had a tragic accident off the coast of South Vietnam during a shelling mission in support of ground forces. The men in turret number 2 numbered about 14, as I recall, and they had an accident while loading an 8-inch projectile during the height of the shelling mission. Unfortunately, a projectile jammed in the barrel of the middle turret, and the powder bag behind that projectile went off in the process and immediately killed 20 individuals. Well, I happened to be on duty at that moment. I was a radioman at the time, and I was the relay station between that ship and the SINCPAC fleet, the organization was called in Hawaii. In the process of that night at 0100 when the accident happened, one of the first things that I did was to handle a message from that ship indicating that they were in trouble, that they'd had something go wrong in turret number 2. It promptly filled the ship from stem to stern with smoke. And as I say, in just an instant, 20 people were killed. I had just turned 20 years of age, and next thing I did was type up the casualty report, at least that night, of those who were missing. And I noticed that in that process, most of the individuals in that accident were 18 and 19 years of age, which really struck me because I was an old man compared to those guys. And that made an impression on me that night to be in contact with those individuals and be involved in that particular military mission. I guess my own mortality, it probably landed squarely on me for the first time in my life when I realized that people who were 18 and 19 years old were actually dying in the service of their country, not only on those ships, but also in country in Vietnam. And when you look at the Vietnam Wall today, it would be astonishing to you to see how many names of the 58,000 there are individuals, men and women, who were 18, 19, and 20 years of age. It's absolutely astonishing to think of that. Our country has called upon people of this age to serve in times of trouble, when our way of life needs to be defended, or when our interests do. We regularly then and regularly now call on people who are 18, 19, and 20 years of age to sacrifice, and in some cases pay the supreme sacrifice, for this nation's interests. That's really the way I approach this. I've been in this job long enough to realize it is not rocket science. There is certainly some life experience that needs to be brought into this. But we all, no matter what age we are, bring that life experience to this process. As I was mentioning in my floor speech on the House side, the experience that I had at 18, 19, and 20 is vastly different from what the young people of this age bring to this process today. I in no way would have wanted to serve in this body at that age, and sometimes even today. Well, anyway, you can finish that up. But with that in mind, there are a number of people who would like to serve, and I dare say would be capable to do that in the 18, 19, and 20-year-old age bracket. They would have to indeed go through everything we have had to go through to serve in this body. It is not a free ride for anyone, as you well know. And with these thoughts in mind, I would just highly recommend the passage of the bill.
Senator Minnick, you.
I don't want to demean your story by any stretch of the imagination. You know, as a police officer, I've seen a lot of people killed, too, domestically here in our own country. So I don't want your story to demean the tragedy of those kind of things happening. But you mentioned that you went into the military by virtue of an authorization note from your parents. I assume then you were less than 18 years of age.
I was 17 at the time.
So would you suggest that we amend this, that a 17-year-old might be able to run for the legislature with a note from their parent?
No, Senator, thank you for the question through the chair. I think 18 will be sufficient.
Well, and I knew that you'd probably say that. The question then is, why 18 again? The justification is, well, we call on people to serve their country at age 18. I did, too. I went into the Air Force in 1972. In fact, June 5th, 1972. So I want to get established here. What the rationale for 18? Because this really leads to another question I want to ask you about, whether or not police officers should be 18 years of age. Whether our drinking age should be reduced to 18 years of age or other restrictions like that, because I don't think you can really separate the two. They're really all one argument, I think.
Well, Senator, thank you for your question. The ages are arbitrary to say for sure, and we deal with maturity level, and we have to guess at maturity level. And so, as I say, the numbers are arbitrary. Right now, we look at 21 for service here. The movement to 18 is an arbitrary number that our society has used for a number of things. Arguably, could a person of 17 years of age serve well in this legislature? Perhaps so, if they've reached a certain maturity level. So this is certainly not science in picking the age of 18, but it seems like a logical number to pick, and that we tend to use those numbers for other things. And so in that respect, I don't have a problem with that. Relating to a person of 17 serving as a law enforcement officer or younger. I have some experience serving as a reserve deputy in Josephine County, a road deputy on swing shift on Friday nights for 5 years, and so I know a little bit about that. Certainly not as you would, being in the trenches as you've been for many years. I would be against the serving at 17 as a law enforcement officer, primarily for the burdens that you would have to carry away if you had to fatally shoot someone in the line of duty. That is something that I've contemplated many, many times as a reserve deputy on Friday nights, and trying to plan on what my reaction would be to certain circumstances, and the gravity of doing that is something that I don't think that you want to force on anyone too soon. And so that's why, is there a difference between 17 and 18? Perhaps not with maturity level, but I would be extremely concerned, as I am our nation's use of people that age in the defense of our nation, which involves taking human life. I would be extremely concerned about having law enforcement officers who potentially would have to do that at 17 or 18 years of age and carry that burden with them for the rest of their lives.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Wilson.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Sarah Haynes, Gregory McNeil, Anastasia Panas?
Thank you for hearing us today. My name is Greg McNeil. I'm from the University of Oregon. I'm a board member of the College Republicans there, and I'm originally from Vernonia, Oregon in Columbia County. Approximately a year ago, I was a student at Portland Community College, and Secretary of State Bill Bradbury came to speak, and I had the opportunity to ask him a question. The question I asked him was, how is it that as a citizen of the state, being that I was 19 years of age at the time, I could pay tax, I could join the National Guard and potentially die for my state, but I could not serve in the legislature? Well, he had no answer, and a year later, here we are.
So you've met the Secretary of State before?
I have met the Secretary of State. I feel that this is a good bill. I think that the major argument against it is experience, and I think experience is in the eye of the beholder. I think a recent high school graduate likely would know more about the educational system than perhaps a lawyer who hasn't been to school in 30 years.
Watch it.
That was the second message.
With that 53.8 accent.
Well, you haven't. You haven't been to school in 20 years.
At least. I haven't even been to a CLE for that long.
I think we all...
The more you guys talk, the deeper hole you're making.
I think we all align ourselves with parties and whatnot, Republican, Democrat. Some of us are Greens and some of us are reformers. We align ourselves with those parties because of the views and the platforms of those parties. And we don't set up parties and whatnot based on your level of experience. There's no party for people just graduated from high school or people about to collect retirement. So I'll leave you with a question. When you all campaign for office and ask voters to vote for you, and you vote in other elections, do you vote for the one with the most experience or the candidate that best represents your views?
Most experience.
And I'll take any questions.
Been our minutes.
How do you define experience?
Chairman Harper, Senator Menace. I think, how do I personally define experience?
Let me give you a quick one. Something happens to you that you wish to God it happened to somebody else.
Well, I... I think...
pretty good.
I don't know. I think you take everything... you need to take every experience you have, no matter how insignificant it may seem, and learn from it. And I think everybody has different backgrounds, different experiences. Some people do a lot of growing up in a short amount of time, and some people take a long time to grow up. And I think experience is something that everybody has to kind of define themselves.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm here today to testify for HGR 16-2. For the record, my name is Anastasia Panis, and I go to the University of North Carolina, but I'm from Salem, so I'm back from summer. I'll keep it short and sweet, since you guys have requested that a few times. pretty much the same arguments as everybody else before me has had. In Oregon, you can run for Attorney General, Secretary of State, and State Treasurer when you're 18, but you have to be 21 to serve in the legislature. And not every 18, 19, and 20-year-old is prepared to serve in the legislature, but I personally know someone that could do it just as well as anybody else could. But then there's a lot of people that couldn't.
Competition's not that great, is that what you're saying?
No. Very stiff competition. But I think... I support HR 16 because it's only fair to allow all adults to run, give them the opportunity to run for a seat in the Oregon legislature. So,
thank you, Senator Menace.
What are you majoring in?
Political science.
Ah, all right. How do you define experience? No, never mind. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, you want me to answer or you don't?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. Well, experience is, there are things that happen to you every day in life that they shape your opinions on of why you think of something the way you do. Like, what things that happen to you, I don't know. My dad has lung cancer, and so when people talk about, I guess I have a different opinion about things like that than someone who's never been affected by it. So just the things that happen to you in your life that shape your, it's what shapes your views on your whole outlook on life.
Good. That's your answer. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Haynes. I'm a student at Pacific University in Forest Grove, but I'm from Grants Pass in Southern Oregon. I'm testifying today in favor of top strength.
You're listening to Representative Wilson when he's on the radio?
Well, I'm really not home that much because I go to school. But if I was home, I would. I'm testifying today in favor of this bill because I think it's important, and I think that all legal adults in the state have a right to run for legislative office. I think that, if we were to say that a certain ethnic group or gender was unable to, to block them from running for legislative office, I think we shouldn't discriminate in terms of age for citizens that also direct important legislative policy through their votes and through their activism. I believe that that 18 through 20-year-olds, I mean, sure, I mean, you can argue that most probably wouldn't be able to effectively do a legislative job, but I would also argue that many certified 21 and above adults are not sort of would not be eligible for the job. I think it's a small minority of individuals who are able to do the job effectively, but I think that we should allow all adults an equal chance at this. I'm just going to keep this short because you've heard most of the arguments that are present, but I just want to say that also HR 16 does not mandate that 18 to 20-year-olds be elected. It doesn't set a requirement. It doesn't guarantee that they'll be elected, but it does give young adults, young voting adults, the chance to run for office, and I think that that's fair, that's reasonable, and that it should, I urge you guys to please pass this today to a work session and to the floor. Thank you.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm associated with a particular caucus, the BFC caucus, and we meet over at the Ram Pub, and it's a group of legislators, and my concern is that if you were elected, you would not be allowed to be on the premises during our caucus meeting. So my question to you is, if we would allow you the right to vote, if we would allow you the right to be a legislator, if we ask you to fight and die for your country, what should the drinking age be in this state?
You know, I don't know. I don't really feel that's the issue here. I mean, Europe has different standards than the United States, but they also have a different culture. I mean, certain
have
states.
Have you thought about it, though?
Well, of course. I mean,
you're
Oklahoma.
Old enough to be responsible to be a legislator?
Mm-hmm.
Would you be old enough to be responsible to handle alcohol?
I think that depends on the person, and I mean, Oklahoma had a law that was overturned by the Supreme Court that allowed 2.3% alcohol beer to be bought by females aged 18 and older, and I mean, there are strange laws like that that exist everywhere, and I mean, I would not assume to be able to judge the law that should govern the country and change the existing law right now. I don't really have the answer to that question.
Chair Harper, if I could add something to that. I think I could be wrong, but isn't the reason that it's 21, it has to do with, like, the maturity of the body, like the body not being able to handle alcohol, not so much that the person isn't able to decide, but just, like, the body can't handle it. And so I think it's more of, like, it's dangerous for people under 21. And I don't know what y'all do, but I don't know if you're dangerous or being the legislature would be dangerous, but...
Be emotionally traumatized.
Maybe your body.
Nick, do you have an opinion?
Do I have an opinion? Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, it's my understanding that the reason that the age limit is 21 is due to kind of federal blackmail. Earlier in our country's history, states regulated their own, and federal government said that they would withhold road money if they did not adjust the ages to 21. The reason for that was that in varying towns on the borders of states, you could go across, get alcohol, come back drunk, and get in accidents. So I don't know if the age should be 21 or not, but I think that being that it's uniform is a good thing. And as far as your caucus, if I were in your caucus, I'd just wait outside, I suppose.
That's what they make me do.
Thank you. All right. Thank you. Nicole LaFour?
Okay. Hello, Chair Harper and members of the
Hello, Nicole.
How are you doing?
I'm fine.
For the record, my name is Nicole LaFour. I'm just going to make this short and sweet and to the point. I just want to urge you to support HJR 16 and move to a work session. So.
Senator Menes.
Cole, do you have any idea what the people of the state of Oregon feel about this?
We could ask them.
If you have any idea, have you done any polling?
No. No, I'm Chair Harper and Senator Menes, no, I'm not done any polling.
Anybody going to run a campaign to pass this thing?
Yes. Chair. Chair Harper and Senator Menes, to pass the...
Chair, we pass this thing out. Who's going to run the campaign to get the message out?
I'm sorry, who?
Who's going to run the campaign? Is there going to be a campaign?
We're
just going to send this thing out there with no explanation and no campaign.
Chair Harper and Senator Menes, yes.
Yes.
There will be a campaign behind HJR 16.
Who's running it?
Who's run?
Yeah. Never mind. It's okay. Don't worry about
it. Chair Harper and Senator Menes, I'd like to take it one step at a time, so we can get this out.
Yeah. All right, further questions?
Okay, that's it.
Okay, thank you very much. Close public hearing. Open work session.
I move House Joint Resolution 16, the Senate floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Senator Cordy moves HCR 16 to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Further discussion, committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Menes.
Well, I just want to say something. I think that the young folks that spoke here today, and I say young folks, I assume they're over 18, not again to be condescending, but I think that their explanations and their answers to questions are remarkable. I think they're outstanding young men and women. And I think the thing that gives me some comfort with respect to this bill isn't the fact that you can join the military or potentially serve in your country and pay the ultimate sacrifice through some military action, but I think the fact that you'll have to stand election is really the answer to the question, that you'll have to take your views, your ideas, and you're going to have to demonstrate to the voters that, in fact, you are capable of carrying on the role of representing them in the legislative body. And that's really, to me, the answer to the question. I think you're quite capable of doing that, and I'm willing to support it based on that.
Okay. I appreciate you coming forward. I think the gentleman, all of us up here are giving back in some manner or fashion. Some have some weird ways of giving back, but they're all here for, really very altruistic reasons. So I think that's good. But any other objections to the bill? Okay. Very none so ordered. I will carry a piece of it. Somebody want another piece? Or Senator Atkinson for sure.
Mr. Chair, I also think Senator Deckard, being the very youngest member of the Oregon Legislature at this point in time,
he'll just drag us down. All right, closed work session. Okay, perhaps open work session on LC 4332. Well, perhaps the most important committee bill of the session, Senator Courtney.
Just a minute, Mr. Chair. I want to find where I'm talking about. 43. Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 4332 be submitted to be adopted as committee bill.
Senator Cordy moves LC 4332 be submitted as committee bill. The sign-a-die resolution. Any objections?
Mm-hmm.
Hearing none, so ordered.
You vote for a work session right now.
It takes 16 to pull it from committee. Open work session. 3550. Merger, you ready? 2981?
Yeah.
All right. Open work session 2981. John Chandler. What's broken here? What are we fixing?
What's the urban sprint? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Building Industry Association. I was hoping somebody would get me up here to talk about being 18, because I remember that vaguely. But I don't think even anybody would buy that. Here on House Bill 2981, to answer your question, Mr. Chairman, what's broken is the process dealing with what is called in the bill urban fringe. That's land immediately outside of an urban growth boundary that may be used for future urban expansion. Last year, I'll give you the short version, this issue's been kicking around for quite some time. Last year, the LCDC made the urban reserve rule voluntary and adopted another rule which did implement a minimum lot size within 1 mile of certain urban growth boundaries. What this bill does is tell LCDC to go back and take another look at the issue of what to do with urban fringe land. Very shortly, the issue is when you go to move an urban growth boundary, assuming that one ever does in this state, if you pardon an editorial comment, but when you go to expand one, the issue is what happens if the land immediately outside that boundary is too cut up and parcelized to be used for urban development. That puts more pressure on farmland that isn't good for development or the environment. But the current laws in place of the administrative rules simply aren't working, in our opinion, to try to address that problem. 2981 does, it passed the House in good form. The only grumpiness about it is from the governor's office. I don't know how grumpy they are. They're still talking about it. And that has nothing to do with the substance. It has to do with the fact that this would require LCDC to do rulemaking, which is a budgetary issue for them. Substantively, 1,000 friends, cities and counties, and everyone else is fine. There are amendments to the bill. -6 amendments.
Four
amendments. Right here. Very nice amendments. What they do from the bill in chief is change the definition of urban fringe. In the bill in chief, it says it's land within 1 mile of a UGB. That seemed to be a bit strict for some folks. We changed it to say it's land outside the boundary that might be used for future urban expansion. 1,000 friends is fine with that amendment, as are cities, counties, and who all. With that, I will hush.
I got to quit in about 5 minutes.
And everybody is okay.
As Mr. Chairman has stated, everybody's okay with it, with the exception of DLCD and, by extension, perhaps the governor, and that's primarily one of whether or not they'll have money in their budget to do the rulemaking.
Do I have a fiscal?
No.
We need to give him something to veto anyway.
Yeah.
I'm always happy to provide that service, Senator Minnis. I have done so on occasion in the past.
Okay. Further questions? No? All right.
Mr. Chairman, you want me to move the OU in a work session status?
In a work session? I don't know. Close public hearing, open work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the -B4 amendments to House Bill 2981.
Senator Cordy moves the B4s to House Bill 2981. Further discussion, objection, hearing none. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2981 as amended to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Cordy moves House Bill 2981 as amended before the do-pass recommendation. Further discussion, objection, hearing none. So ordered.
Thank you.
Senator Courtney, the building industry bill, so he'll carry this one. Close his work session. Work session. House Bill 3550.
I get a whole bunch of bills to carry.
3550 it was?
3550.
Yeah, that's what you're carrying.
Okay.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ken Armstrong representing the Oregon Ports Group here in support.
Senator Atkinson.
I have a question. Perhaps you could tell us what happened in your family this week before you go any further.
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, I'd be happy to. We had our second baby girl, and 8 pounds on Tuesday of last week.
8 pounds?
8 pounds,
ouch.
Yep. The first one was 8-13, so I figured we're getting better. And she's healthy, mom's doing fine, and so the family has grown, and as has been told to me, I'll certainly corroborate, having two is more than twice the workload. So, thank you.
Well, congratulations, buddy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. House Bill 3550 addresses a pretty straightforward problem. The Marine Navigation Improvement Fund exists within the Economic Development Department to pay for dredging projects.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3550. And Gross's House floor, Senate floor, do pass recommendation.
Senator Cordy moves House Bill 3550 to the floor of the do pass recommendation.
I draw, but you know.
You got to get back to help your wife with that kid.
Thank you. I'm going to use that next session, too. Thank you.
Keep having kids.
Meyer, you need a
good lobbying tactic.
Oh, sure. All right. Senator Byer would be happy to. Closed work session, open work session. House Bill 3386.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to give an announcement on a development in my family. Senator Courtney. Okay. This bill deals with the fire district situation. What we want to try and do is give fire districts the authority to help pay for the retroactive installation of sprinkler systems within multifamily residential. I'd be more than happy to go on further if you would like.
All right. Thank you. Senator Courtney.
I move House Bill 3386.
Courtney moves House Bill 3336. Gross before the due pass recommendation. Further discussion, objection, hearing none. So ordered.
Thank you.
Let's see. Senator Atkinson, we need one of these bills.
I'd be delighted.
Okay.
Thrilled. That's what I do.
Closed work session, open work session. House Bill 2502? 2502. Doug Dennis Charles.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Doug Riggs, here representing Metro. I believe Dennis Mulvihill is upstairs in public affairs. I can make this very brief. We could go into as much detail as you want, but this is a simple correction of a bill passed in 1999. There was an effort to restrict the use of community centers in rural areas to centers that were intended only for and by rural residents. And it had the effect of also restricting the use of public parks in rural areas. And so the interpretation has been over the last 2 years that it's difficult to site rural parks in rural areas unless they are intended to be run by and only for rural residents. As you well know, in Oregon, parks are intended to be used by rural, urban, and any other resident in the state of Oregon. So our amendment in 2502 makes a technical change, returns the definition for siting parks to the definition that we had prior to 1999. Great. Supported by everybody. Opposed by no one.
Bill.
Thank you.
Senator Courtney.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash.
Yes, everybody for this? Everybody okay?
For it. What are the amendments, James?
There's no amendments.
No amendments?
Mm-hmm.
Courtney, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2502 as amended, A and Gross to send for a due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2502, A and Gross to forward a due pass recommendation. Further discussion, objection, hearing none. So ordered. Carrier, Senator Menace?
Yes,
first. That'd be okay?
Yeah,
all right. 2804 will hold. There's some having wrestling with amendments.
Bye-bye.
Open work session, House Bill 3339.
What happened, Mr.
They got some.
Whoops.
3533.
Oh, that's, yeah, we're holding
sorry.
That too. Yeah.
All right, go ahead.
Okay. House Bill 3339.
And that's
the Cruz bill.
Yeah, the witness sheet, please. House Bill 3339, public hearing and work session, possible work session. Bruce Bishop, Representative Jeff Cruz, and
Grant
Higginson. I'm sorry, I should know that name. Please, let everyone come forward whose name I called. Okay, could you start, Mr. Dr. Higginson, please?
Vice Chair Courtney, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I am the acting administrator for the Oregon Health Division Department of Human Services, which is the state's public health agency. As I think all of you know, last year we had problems with influenza vaccine. There was a substantial delay, and consequently, because of that, a number of people who were in high-risk categories did not get vaccinated. On the other hand, a number of people who were really low-risk from the disease did get vaccinated. Consequently, at the request of the House Committee on Health and Public Advocacy, the Health Division was asked to come in, present what happened last year with the problems for the flu vaccine and what the state legislature might do in order to correct those problems. from that, we have worked with the chair of the committee, Representative Cruz, and with the industry, and from that come up with what is before you today, House Bill 3339A, which we believe is supported not only by us, but by the industry of vaccine providers and the healthcare professionals as well. What the bill does is it gives us authority to write guidelines for the distribution and the and the administration of vaccine should there be a significant shortage or delay. That is something that actually we can do without legislation. That's something that we did last session, the issue, last fall when the problem arose. The problem, however, though, is that we had no teeth to enforce those guidelines, and so what House Bill 3339A does is does provide a civil penalty to get us some enforcement authority.
Thank you, Dr. Goodson. Mr. Bishop, do you have anything to add to what he said?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much. You're both dismissed from witness stand. Well, shoot.
You got it. Yes, he's right there.
Oh, there he is. All right. We're in work session.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 3339 to the floor of the DuPass recommendation.
Senator Byron moves House Bill 3339 and goes to the Senate floor of the DuPass recommendation. Are there any objections? Hearing and seeing none, it is done. Anybody here particularly want to carry that kind of bill? Anybody really in love with it?
Okay.
Who's that? Representative Minister? Representative Minister, she's the cure of the vaccination bill. I'd like to go to House Bill 3953. You took that one off? Sorry, made a mistake. Now we go to House Bill. Is this the one here?
Yeah.
Or is this one easier?
We did that.
All right. House Bill 3363, please. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Katie Kate, representing the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. We bring you today House Bill 3363, which defines wolf hybrids as predators and predatory animals in the state of Oregon. Currently, there are 20,000 wolf hybrids in the state of Oregon, and for your information, a wolf hybrid can be a wolf cross with domestic dogs, feral ant dogs, or coyotes. This does not affect wolves that might cross into the state of Oregon, and it is non-conflict with the Federal Endangered Species Act. Currently, for a rancher to take a wolf hybrid, the animal must be chasing or killing the livestock. This does not allow for the prevention of damage to agriculture. In Oregon, the ranching landscape is one that ranchers cannot be with their animals at all times and protect them from wildlife at all times. The predatory definition expansion would allow wolf hybrids to be under the same regulations as coyotes in the state of Oregon. And this allows landowners to take predatory animals on their property to prevent the damage of agriculture. All the cattlemen are asking for today is to prevent damage to their livestock and the ability to protect them as well. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions, please? Okay, can I just ask one? You obviously know there's some opposition to this. I'm not trying to trick you on that.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know? Are they obvious that they're hybrids?
Parents? Senator Courtney, wolves are extinct in the state of Oregon.
Aye.
There would only be a few counties where people would be under the risk of being in contact with a wolf, and that would be the ones bordering Idaho, where we have had very few crossovers. And normally, I believe a landowner would know if there was a wolf hybrid in the area.
Well, okay. I must tell you something. When I was at Western Oregon University, still there, we got I think it was a hybrid. We didn't know it. It looked like a Malamute or one of those kinds. It became a mascot. We called it Wolfy, but we kept it in certain areas. And it was territorial within the student union. I don't know. My point was, I'm not sure I could tell. Maybe other people could. I mean, I don't know how you make these distinctions. And maybe clearly, if it is very much looking like a wolf, you know, a wolf. But if you say that, that's fine. I was just wondering because of my personal experience. The animal's now deceased. It was full age.
But I remember at the time we had to take it. We took it one day to the Department of Ag for some reason. And I forget why we did that. We had to actually take it in. They looked at it and did certain things with it. And that was about 10 years ago, so I don't know. Anyway, I was trying to, yes, go ahead, sir.
Hey, am I incorrect? Now you can shoot a dog if it's chasing livestock, can't you?
Correct. Chair Courtney and Senator Beyer, it has to be chasing or killing the livestock. It does not allow, the current law does not allow for any prevention of animals from chasing. It has to be caught in the act.
What are we trying to get at?
What our bill would do is allow for us to take an animal that's on private property before or after it chases or kills livestock. Currently, to kill a dog in the state of Oregon, it has to be in the act of chasing or killing livestock.
That's a little different than the farmers in my area.
If a coyote is in my front yard, can I shoot it?
Yes, if it's on your property.
Not in the city.
I can't do it.
Can't do it in the city.
All right. Well, if I'm out in Baker City or something, Baker City, where I go a lot, and I see a coyote, I can shoot it, right? Regardless of what it's doing, I can shoot it.
Senator Courtney, if you're on your own property,
it's on my property.
Then you could, regardless if you're in city limits or if you're acting as an agent for the landowner.
Great. Thank you. Further questions, Katie, please. Senator Minnis.
How much of a lead do you have to get on them?
Chair Courtney and Senator Minnis, I'm not an expert in this, so I would believe they're pretty quick. They're about 150 pounds, so it's going to be a pretty swift animal.
Okay, more questions for Katie? Thank you very much for coming here today and testifying on this legislation. We do have, the chair has left for the day and asked me to continue, and there's some letters here we have, obviously, from the Humane Society and Cattlemen's Association. Of course, you have Katie's testimony. Was there another letter?
Oregon Farm.
Oregon Family Farm. So, Senator Byron.
I'm just going to ask. What happens now? Don't they just shoot them? The dogs and stuff. I mean, I have not, growing up in a rural area, it wasn't exactly a problem.
Sure, come on up. Sure, come on up here.
Chair Courtney and Senator Beyer, Roger Huffman from the Oregon Department of Agriculture is here as well, and he is more of the expert on this. But is your question referring to dogs or?
I don't find the problem. I mean, the people just do it. I mean, the farmers that I know, if they're on their private land, they assume that they're chasing their animals, and they happen to have their deer rifle with them, the dog's done.
Senator Courtney and Senator Beyer, what we're asking for is to be able to do it in the legal form of the law and not to be getting through on a loophole. Currently, under the state law, the animal must be chasing or killing livestock. And where our ranching operations are, you will see the animal. You might see forms of damage or be missing cattle, but you will not be there to be there during the act of the damage. And so that's all we're asking for today is the ability to take a wolf hybrid when it is on our property.
I don't know.
Okay. I didn't mean to distract. Obviously, we're talking about the other bill. Okay. Thank you very much, Katie. Mm-hmm. I'm going to move on to the other bill. May I do that, please? Because I'm not there on this bill just yet. I mean, I'm not trying to play power structure, but power play. But I just
only four people here.
Well, I'm not trying to talk. Okay. Open the House Bill 3808, a public hearing, possible work session. And Glenn Stonebrink, would you come forward, please, from the Oregon Cattlemen's Association on 3808, please?
What?
Who's him? Oh, Jeff. Yeah. Representative Jeff. Well, we tried to also get Jeff Cruz, and he didn't make it. Of course, his bill went out, so he's ought to be happy about this.
What?
Thank you.
You know, it's funny. I don't know what happened to that last bill. A lot of people in the room, they sent us literature, but didn't Tennis literature, but nobody came. I felt sort of alone up here. Yes, Mr. Cattleman, would you talk to us, please, about 3808?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen Association. This bill was brought by the Oregon Cattlemen Association, and mostly at the request of Representative Jeff Krupp, who happens to live in an area near Albany where land was purchased, private land was purchased by the federal government, and then the idea is that that land will be turned into a migratory bird refuge. A number of people, farmers, that were right next to this land that would become a migratory bird refuge objected, and it was, I believe, 300 people who objected to this, but that, beside the point, is going to go ahead anyway. The point I'm getting to here on federal purchase of land, in the United States Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, is an interesting clause because the founders found it important enough to say that if the federal government purchases land within a state, and if they want exclusive jurisdiction, and that's a very crucial phrase, if they want exclusive jurisdiction, the federal government, over that land, then they must get the approval of the state legislature. Now, that's in the United States Constitution. So why don't we do that? Every time the federal government buys this land and they want exclusive jurisdiction over it, which you might think would be something like a military base, would it be obvious they would need that kind of exclusive jurisdiction. But in this state, they don't have to do that. Why? Is because the legislature in 1967 passed the law, and it's referred to as ORS 272.060 in this case, which basically gives a free pass to the federal government to have that exclusive jurisdiction without getting the legislature's approval. And that's on your second page. You can see the red X is what this bill would be doing, is removing that free pass for migratory birds. It does not stop the federal government from purchasing land. It does not stop them from purchasing. It just says if you're going to purchase and if you want exclusive jurisdiction, which, by the way, the Migratory Bird Act, the Federal Migratory Bird Act, also requires legislative approval. If they want that, then they must come to the legislature and get the approval. And so in this situation, and we had a bill similar to this last session, but we've included almost everything in it to be taken out. And there was no objection to this part by the governor on 272.060. And so we're just concentrating on that portion whatsoever. And I'd relinquish my time to Representative Jeff Krupp.
Yes, Representative Krupp, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for not being more timely. However, we're on the floor vote.
Right.
Did you just receive this from my staff?
We did. We just got it right here. It's just been handed to us.
Thank you. That just basically summarizes my testimony and what this bill does, the reason for it. Let me tell you what the real reason behind this bill is from my perspective. This last year, up the road from my farm about 5 miles, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service came in and purchased a piece of property known as Snag Boat Bend. Over 300 of the neighbors signed petitions saying they didn't think this was a good idea. And the reason they wanted this land is they wanted it for migratory bird refuges. And as you know, down in our neck of the woods, we have a tremendous problem with geese and ducks and predation in the fields. They just ruin the crops. We don't need any more birds. We've got tons of birds as they are. In fact, in the last 10 years, all of the birds of all types, and I have the statistics here, Mr. Chair, have doubled. And that's a matter of fact. We don't need any more birds down in our neck of the wood. We got plenty as they are. So the fact that the federal government wouldn't listen to us, the local landowners and adjoining neighbors.
I'm not laughing. I
understand.
I don't need more birds. Somehow or other.
Alan
Hitchcock. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that.
That's perfectly all right. I hope to get you up in my bird after a while, Senator. So
there's all kinds of birds.
Yes. What this bill does, it repeals the ORS 272060. Which grants automatic state approval. I think that based on the governor's veto message, which I have here from last session, he says, and I quote, "I believe that the acquisition of land by the federal government in the state is a matter best left for the state to decide on a case-by-case basis." I think that really says it all. That's what we're asking to do here. And, Senator, I'd be happy to provide you with a copy of that. I did not. That's my apologies to the committee. That's what we're doing here. we're simply saying that only for migratory bird refuges, and only them, not for navigational aids, not for forest, not for anything else, but only for migratory bird refuges, that the state would have the permission or have the ability to say yes or no, depending on if they want to abide by our laws. If they want to abide by our laws, we have no right to say you have to have our permission. If they want exclusive jurisdiction, and this is in the opinion of legislative counsel, if they want to abide by their laws and not our state land use laws and our water rights laws, then they need to come get our permission. That's all we're doing here. We're doing nothing more.
Thank you, Representative Krupp. Other questions for Representative Krupp and Mr. Stonebrink? The governor vetoed this last session. Is that what you're telling me?
Mr. Chair, the governor vetoed Senate Bill 989, which was far, far broader than this piece of legislation. It dealt with all of the federal acquisitions, which would have had issues regarding national forests, navigational aids, a whole list of issues. And I will provide the governor's veto message to you at this time, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I'm looking for, well, here, we have it here. Is your files, just for the sake of while here, Representative Preppers, do your files contain dissenting letters? My files, is there being those? So I'm just sort of curious to know what's going on here. Anybody got anything to say to me on this?
No, but I have the same memo.
Yeah, I've got the memo, right, and I've got that. I'm just curious. What happened? The vote was not... You won in the House, but you did have some opposition. What was going on there? Is that, you want to tell us, it's just not anything more than that? The only reason I'm saying is before, Senator Brown, you're out here, in the last bill, there were several letters against what we were trying to do, but no, it wasn't opposition in terms of verbal testimony. Here, I don't have any letters or anything, so but obviously there's just some dissent going on here. I can think of why, but I just wonder what's going on. Was there more than that?
Mr. Chair, I think the day we were voting on this, we were voting on a couple of other issues that were fairly contentious. And as happened with yesterday's circumstance, another one of my bills, which is a great bill that will be before you, was also fell victim to certain attitudes at the time based on floor votes.
All right. Any questions, Representative Pimp? Thank you. And Mr. Stonebrink, thank you very much. I don't think anyone else has signed up, right?
So, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you. And with that...
Look forward to taking you flying, Senator.
In my bird.
All right. With that, this hearing is closed, and these committees adjourned.
Oh. Just kidding.